Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast. Fish are amazing creatures with a diversity of colors, shapes, and sizes. They truly are a diverse group of animals, and so are humans. This podcast is more about people than fish, which is also the case in fisheries, believe it or not. Any fisheries manager will tell you, it's about working with people. The fish are the easy part. Here, we focus on people and on extremely important topics, including the benefits of diversity, equity, inclusion in the field of fisheries and aquatic sciences. Some topics may be uncomfortable at times, but this will be a safe zone from which everyone can learn. Although this is an initiative led by Clemson University students and supported by the American Fisheries Society, it applies everywhere and to everyone and transcends fisheries. We strive for everyone to feel involved and included, no matter your country of origin, age, ethnicity, gender, religion, sexuality, and/or disability. Hosts and guests are sharing their personal views, which they hold as their own. We are so glad you chose to listen and open your mind to these very important conversations. Thank you for joining us. I'd like to introduce you to the co-host, Dion Kerr.
As we begin to start this journey, Aaron and I would like to invite all of you to come prepared with an open mind, ready to think critically. I'd like to follow up that statement by saying, generally, humans struggle between what is right and wrong. Our personal morals and ethics are shaped by cultural norms and the ones that surround us, including our family, friends, classmates, and colleagues. Our podcast would like to critique your philosophy by challenging some of your personal beliefs regarding right and wrong. We want you to ask yourself this. Is the way I'm viewing this situation or issue correct, or is it wrong? What is it that I'm not seeing? These are great questions to start with, and it is very important to answer them honestly. Try not to find an answer based on what benefits you, but what's centered around the truth or what matters.
Hey everyone, this is episode 3, and today we're going to be talking about Black Lives Matter movement with Gerard Green.
Gerard Green comes to us from Clemson University's Gantt Multicultural Center. He is currently the Associate Director of Multicultural Programs. Welcome, Gerard.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'd love to hear about your journey and what your job entails. Please introduce yourself. Talk about some of the goals of the Gantt Multicultural Center here at Clemson.
Definitely. Again, thank you both for giving me the opportunity to speak on this topic. It's a topic that's very important and one that I've followed since its creation. So I'm glad to be able to have the opportunity to speak about it today. But really, my journey to where I am today starts back during my time as a college student at Winona State University in Minnesota, Southeast Minnesota. I was an involved student on campus, so I did pretty much everything you can think of in terms of serving as the president of a Black student union. I was an orientation ambassador. I was an admissions tour guide, a student senator, a resident assistant, and so forth, closely with our inclusion and diversity office. Did a lot of different things on campus, which really gave me the opportunity to learn more about higher education. The experience that really led me into my current work today is experience of student activism. So during my sophomore year at Winona State, I went to a conference called the Power and Diversity Leadership Conference, which was a life-changing experience. Long story short, from that conference, we developed our own group on campus to address some of the issues that we had been experiencing across different minoritized communities. So not only students of color, but also queer and trans students on campus, students, religiously diverse students, and so forth. And so from that conversation, from the conference, we developed this initiative called the No Space Coalition, which really was a way to advocate for the fact and highlight the fact that we had no space on campus. We had a couple of offices, but we didn't have a physical center that we could go to and really feel safe and comfortable on campus. From this No Space Coalition, we developed a 3-day demonstration that happened, in the heart of campus, where we built a cardboard structure with 2x4s. We had a petition. We had meetings with university administration, the Higher Learning Commission, for which is a group that was reaccrediting the university that year. Our president was retiring and a new president was coming in. So there were a lot of conditions that really set us up to be successful. And we also, you know, wrote a pretty lengthy diversity report. And all of that ultimately led to the Higher Learning Commission saying, hey, if you all want to be reaccredited year after year or every 5 years, you have to address diversity and inclusion on this campus. And so, you know, a lot of things happened between then and the next spring, where we actually secured a space 2 blocks from our main campus with the promise that when the student union was being renovated, that we would get a space in the student union, which ended up happening the fall after I graduated. And so, you know, through that experience, not only did I have the experience of advocating for underrepresented students and being, you know, kind of that voice, but I also continued to learn about the way that higher education operated. From that point, I really wanted to dedicate myself to a career in higher education, specifically advancing diversity and inclusion and supporting and advocating for historically underrepresented groups. And so after I graduated from Winona State, I went on to graduate school at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where I got a degree in higher education administration. And there I worked closely with our Men of Color Initiative, our Black Graduate Student Organization, and a number of other community-based groups as well, like the Black United Front and some others. And then after I graduated from UMKC with my master's, I went on to work at Truman State University and their Multicultural Center. Shortly after that, I went to the University of Minnesota and worked in their College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences, where I worked in that office for diversity and inclusion within that college. Fisheries and wildlife and agricultural education and horticulture and all these different kind of natural resource sciences and agriculturally based areas are something that I have at least some familiarity with through that experience. I also advised our local manners chapter. And so those are really important and great experiences for me and thinking about, you know, intercultural competence as kind of a different framework for addressing diversity, equity, and inclusion, especially for folks who are newer to the conversation. And so that experience was important for me. And the summer of 2017, I moved to Clemson, really with a desire to get back into a multicultural center. When I first came, it was in the mid to upper 90s, and I instantly wanted to go back to Minnesota, where it was a lot cooler. You know, I've really enjoyed my time at Clemson, despite the challenges and some of the issues and the lack of cultural diversity at Clemson. I really have felt that this was an important move for my career. Like I said, at the end of this month will be 3 years that I've been at Clemson. So that's really what got me to my current space. As far as the Gantt Multicultural Center, you know, our main charge is really to support and advocate for students to develop their capacity to be world changers. When we think about corporations, graduate schools, and you know, the imperative around what these folks are looking for, it's not necessarily the technical hard skills of, can you do this job? Do you know how to, or are you familiar with the technical aspects of this job? But it's, can you work with diverse teams? Can you problem solve with folks who are different from you? Like, what are those soft skills that you bring to the table that sets you apart from everyone else who's graduating with a degree in fisheries or a degree in social work or whatever the program is? And so our hope is to really prepare students to be able to engage in a global society effectively. We also want to provide educational resources to the campus community to build their intercultural competence. So not only how do we support students who are going out into the world, but also need to support students while they're in college as well. Part of that process is developing and enhancing the campus culture to be one that's more welcoming, more inclusive, and more reflective of the diversity that we have on campus. I think that's the other major part of our work is, how can we provide that education and that support to enhance the campus climate so that when folks come here, they feel valued, respected, and are able to flourish. So that's a little bit about me and the work that we do in the Gantt Center, kind of our our main purpose. And our work spans across identity. So we work with students of color. We work with queer and trans students. We work with students with varying religious, spiritual worldviews. We work with students who come from more privileged, majoritized backgrounds and all the intersections in between. We recognize that our work is complex and that it needs to be complex to serve the complex needs of our students.
You touched on a really important aspect, a training to be able to work with a diverse population, whether it be in a university setting or in a professional setting, is just really important. Having that ability to sit side by side with someone who is different than you and be able to get the job done and have a positive work environment. And that's really how it applies to all professions, specifically to fisheries in this context. So, and I really appreciate, you mentioned the word world changer, and I think you're doing that. I think you are doing that. With your background and your dedication. And we just really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, and kind of going off of your last point too, with developing that sort of environment at universities where people come to visit, they want to feel included or like this environment is for them. I think that's really important. It's awesome that, you know, you're a part of doing something like that for these schools, because I think oftentimes, at least for me, when you hear the words diversity and inclusion, I feel like the word inclusion gets overlooked. Because I, you know, without inclusion or feeling included, I just don't think it's hard to make a diverse environment if people aren't going to feel welcome.
I completely agree with that. It's one thing to make a professional workplace setting diverse. It is another thing to have those individuals feel included. That's one of the key points that I've learned in my current training here at Clemson.
Well, and I've seen many examples where folks are hired. And I mean, there's a lot of conversation about even the role of chief diversity officers on campus and how they're often hired as symbol or a placeholder, but they're not given the credence or the actual decision-making power to drive change within the institution. And so it's not enough, as you said, it's not enough to diversify. You have to have an inclusive environment where people have voice and people have the ability to make decisions and really effectuate change.
That's awesome. Before we dive into the main content, I have a brief question since we're on this topic. Gerard, do you have any thoughts or suggestions on management or faculty where their potential future students might be a person of color? Do you have any ideas or some input on what faculty and other employers should kind of keep in mind as, you know, more and more people of color begin to join the sciences or even just to kind of take on graduate school?
This question is particularly present in my life right now because I see colleges and universities around the country in some ways thriving or in other ways struggling to think about, you know, with the mass unrest that's happened in this country over the last few months, like how do we respond in a way that is effective and meaningful to our most minoritized communities? You know, a lot of this, I think, comes from, this is a higher education problem of this continuous cycle of being reactive. And I think that the biggest piece of advice really that I have is, you know, we hired D&I professionals on campuses to do this work. And I think, you know, while it serves as a good placeholder to be able to say, this is what we're doing, I don't know that folks actually listen to the DEI folks, because our work is not only grounded by our personal experiences often, but also grounded by research, empirically based research from scholars around the country through history. And if we take the time to learn about what the scholarship says and what people are saying who are experts in this work, you know, we can truly be proactive in thinking about how do we create an environment that welcomes the influx of underrepresented populations on campus versus has to now react to the influx. So we know that, and this information comes from our director for Hispanic Outreach that in the state that the average age for a Hispanic student is 16 years old right now. So our Hispanic community and population is growing significantly. And that also means that, you know, these are rising sophomores, rising juniors. And so in the next couple of years, we're going to see a huge increase, more than we've already seen in the last few years, of Hispanic and Latinx students on our college campuses. And so thinking about that, we need to be preparing for what that looks like and how we're going to create an environment that truly supports and connects to those communities. So I think that the biggest thing that I could recommend is the folks who do DEI work on campus are there to help and there to continue advocating for change. And I think that it's important for those who don't do that work and aren't as familiar to recognize, you know, they don't have to be the expert.
Thanks for all that information, Gerard. That you had some points that, you know, I never thought of with, you know, the average age of Hispanics. So, I mean, and then just kind of highlighting that boom that's expected to occur within universities. So I want to move forward, ask you essentially, you know, if we can take a dive into the Black Lives Matter movement, could you explain to our listeners what this social movement is all about, Gerard?
Definitely. To understand the Black Lives Matter movement is to understand intersectionality based on interlocking systems of oppression. That's what makes it unique. Not to necessarily say our prior movements weren't intersectional, because, you know, around civil rights, it was about race and class, economics related to that. And it was about, there are very prominent figures within the civil rights movement who identified as Black and queer and Black women. So that's not to say that our movements in the past haven't been intersectional, but I think that a difference with the Black Lives Matter movement is that it was designed to be intersectional. And so the Black Lives Matter movement was founded in 2013 after the acquittal of Trayvon Martin's murderer, George Zimmerman. And it was created by three Black women. So we have Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi. I think that it's really important because the movement was designed to ensure that there wasn't erasure in Black lives. So again, with prominent civil rights movements, even like the Young Lords of the 60s and the 70s, the Black Panthers, you know, women, particularly and queer folks in the movement, almost had their place. It was primarily Black, cis, heterosexual men who were at the forefront of these movements. You know, Dr. King, people are very aware of, Huey P. Newton with the Black Panthers. There were a lot of folks behind the scenes who were doing extremely important work who weren't Black men. I think a way for the Black Lives Matter movement is a way to say, Black women have and continue to be at the forefront of change in society, and particularly queer and trans folks. And so we need to ensure that we're not erasing them from this movement. So Black Lives Matter really is designed as a social justice and liberation movement for Black people. I think that it's also started as a way to recognize and illuminate the police violence that is mostly referenced with Black men as well. So we have Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, but also a way to say this is impacting Black women as well. While I think that the initial focus was to highlight police violence within the Black community that has existed for a century, it really shifted to a movement that really addresses and highlights the systemic violence against Black people and advocates for Black liberation as a whole. It's unique, I think, in that it's a decentralized movement. In civil rights, you very much had faces of the movement who were out in front and were very well known and recognized. But Black Lives Matter is a little bit different in that power is given to local communities and local chapters versus a national body or leader, which I think is unique and really giving folks agency to create change within their local communities. I think that the civil rights movement was addressing federal policy the national landscape, which Black Lives Matter does as well. But I think that there's more of an emphasis on local communities through that. And a cool thing about the movement as well is they've become a global space for connecting Black people across the diaspora. So you have Jhenaia Khan, who developed Black Lives Matter Canada, you have Black Lives Matter in the United Kingdom and other places around the world. So it really has become a global space, not only to connect Black people, but to also connect Black liberation in a global space. When we talk about anti-Blackness and anti-Black racism, that's a global phenomenon. Mm-hmm. There are many countries around the world. I mean, even anything in like beauty products and skin lightening creams, you know, the way in which Black people are viewed in certain communities, that's a global experience. It's not just happening in the United States. To have a global network of people addressing anti-Blackness, I think is extremely important. I think that that's what the Black Lives Matter movement has done for society.
Kind of to follow up with all that, I find that Black Lives Matter does receive, for the amount of positivity it receives, I also think there's a balancing pushback with non-support. So we've discussed that it's for the liberation of brutality on Blacks by the police, essentially. At the end of the day, you would think you can just sit there and kind of agree with that and say, you know, yeah, that's an issue. But there are many of those who oppose the movement. And oftentimes, this rejection seems to be tied to political party commitments or beliefs. So where I'm getting at is, you have those who would identify as a Democrat are on the left side of the political scale, and then you have those on the right side or the Republicans. And it seems like, from at least from my own personal experiences and then from just taking a step back, looking at the world and seeing how people are making their decisions on this case, you know, they will say they won't support the movement or this idea simply because their political party doesn't seem to be on that side of the spectrum. I don't think that's fair. And I think that's a big flaw in the way people are going about human rights issue. Would you agree with that? Do you disagree? You know, what are your thoughts on that? Is that something you've observed before?
Yeah, and I kind of have complicated thoughts to this question. I will recognize that, you know, especially in the current administration, there's been a national narrative that Black Lives Matter is exclusionary to other communities, that it is a hate group that should be disbanded, and that we should be cautious about Black Lives Matter. This is the same rhetoric that was used against the Black Panthers, against folks like Dr. King and Malcolm X, folks like other folks within history. So this isn't anything new. The idea of Black liberation and Black communities forming together to create change has always been a threat to society. So while I think that, and I would agree that you can see along partisan lines, there might be more support for the movement among Democrats or politically liberal folk, mm-hmm. in comparison to Republicans or politically conservative folk. We have to look beyond even just the Black Lives Matter movement, which is a 7-year movement, to think about how this mindset has, you know, occurred throughout history.
Yeah.
And I think that you have varying perspectives across political groups as well. So there are probably Democrats who aren't supportive of Black Lives Matter and Republicans who are. So I think that in some ways it's complicated in that way as well. But I would agree that there's a tendency for there to be kind of a partisan divide of who supports Black Lives Matter and who doesn't. I also think that we have to see these two major political parties as two sides to a coin that can both uphold anti-Black racism, white supremacy. So neither party has really effectively worked towards dismantling systemic racism for Black communities and other racially minoritized groups. And, you know, Democrats in the 1990s voted for legislation to increase funding to the police, which effectively militarized the police. And, you know, you have folks like Hillary Clinton who called Black people super predators. So, you know, there are trends that I think we could follow in terms of who tends to be more likely to support the movement versus who doesn't. But I think that there are challenges within both parties that we have to think about and have to address when we look at it as a whole versus the specific movement.
To kind of add to that, Gerard, you made a good point how really neither political parties have done much to kind of dismantle systemic racism. Does that frustrate you at all? Because I feel like your area of work in these sorts of situations become very gray when you start thinking about all of the different scenarios that come up. So what was his name? Was it Rashard Brooks, that recent shooting? Yeah, I find that situation pretty difficult. To go back to the political parties, it just seems like nothing really ever gets done. And with being someone like you working in this field of expertise, do you ever kind of get frustrated, like not seeing progress? Does no progress ever bother you, kill your motivation? Because I myself and others that I know run into that very mindset. Do you have any ideas or thoughts on how to kind of push past that and to keep fighting?
I'm always frustrated. And, you know, I think that a lot of my frustration is what drives me to continue advocating. I think that it's easy to become cynical and, you know, say that nothing's ever going to change, that the system is too large for anyone to truly move away from. So, like, what's the point? You know, I've had those moments over time. I think that my perspective now has shifted significantly since I first entered this work. You know, early on, I really wanted to be the person that came in and saved the world. And I recognize that not only is the system so deeply ingrained into the fabric of society, but also that I'm complicit in the system. Like I often reflect on what are the ways that I'm contributing to anti-Black racism? What are the ways that I'm contributing to other forms of oppression? Because to have the level of privilege that I have in general means that in some ways I'm benefiting from and upholding and reinforcing these systems of oppression. And I think that it's hard for us to truly fathom or, you know, understand, like, what does equitable society look like? Like, what does true equity look like? And I don't know that any of us know that.
Just kind of add into that, it just seems like that thought is tied into it, the country becoming socialist rather than actually trying to. So I feel like that hinders progress too. All right. At least these are some of the things that I tend to see. And that's frustrating because it's not about that. It's literally about treating people fairly. And I guess it all comes back to the golden rule of just treating people how you would like to be treated. But it just seems like this idea turns into the country becoming socialist or something like that. And I think it's just incredible that we can't make progress because that's what people are thinking rather than thinking, trying to appreciate their neighbor, essentially.
And I think there are a lot of things embedded in that. That could be, you know, a whole different podcast in itself. I think that when we talk about socialism and the scares of socialism, you know, I often reflect on how the system of sharing and the system of wealth that is built by those in power and those who have extreme wealth, like a lot of the way that they operate is a function of socialism. Again, I think that, you know, beyond, because I think that what we see as socialism is, you know, I think that people have a difficult time distinguishing socialism from even communism, and the ways in which socialism is based on a collective culture where people are sharing resources and that people have equitable access to similar resources. I don't know that we have a truly socialist society in our world right now. I think that even went to Cuba last summer. So the government prides themselves on being a socialist country based off of Fidel Castro's leadership and kind of take over in mid-20th century. But, you know, when you have the emergence of tourism, which is a huge supplier to Cuba's economy, like you then have an economy that isn't completely socialist. When you have people who are in the tourism industry who are able to make a significant amount of money just by working in restaurants or owning owning some business, some level of business within Cuba. And so I don't know that we truly have a socialist economy in the world. And I'll also say that capitalism is kind of the major economic system that existed after enslavement. And so thinking about capitalism, capitalism is based in racism as well. Racism is part of everything. Racism is endemic. And so, you know, when you consider that, capitalism, there's no ethical way to engage in capitalism either. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of scare happening around what does the socialist economy look like and what is democratic socialism? But at the same time, you know, capitalism has created, and the abuse of capitalism has created a society where we have folks who are part of the 1% who own a significant portion of wealth in this country. In terms of, and you mentioned the golden rule, and you know, in terms of the golden rule, that's something that I struggle with, just because I think that when we think about embodying intercultural competence and leaders who are culturally engaged, the golden rule implies that what you want is similar to what I would want, and vice versa. And I think, you know, a lot of folks have moved toward the platinum rule, which is that we're going to treat others the way that they want to be treated, so that we recognize that there are differences in cultural values and cultural experiences that warrant different approaches or different expectations. So I would say that that's a challenge that I might offer to the golden rule. So what you said about culminating these thoughts, it goes back to our society, which is very individualistic. Like we're not collective at all. We have the belief in meritocracy. We have the belief, you know, if you just work hard and that you can succeed in society. And that negates the very real experiences of oppression that various minoritized communities experience. And it also, you know, during COVID, gives folks the sense of power to say, I'm not going to wear a mask, even though I can see that the numbers and the proportion of folks who are developing COVID or contracting COVID, even in the state of South Carolina, has grown exponentially since, you know, that things started to surface back in January, February, March. You know, to truly embody a collective culture would be a complete paradigm shift from how we understand society, how society has grown and developed over time. I think that that's a lot of the reason why change is so hard, going back to that frustration, is that you can't drive change without building relationships and building coalitions. Like, it just doesn't happen. It doesn't work. And the fact that we can't do that, or we don't do that, means that we're going to still live in a society where individual interests are more important than collective interests.
So, Gerard, you mentioned the platinum rule. Not really sure why. I have never heard that term before, but it makes a lot of sense. And that's something that the listeners can latch on to. So golden rule versus platinum rule. Look up the differences. As we're going through this podcast series, Dion and I are learning a lot, and it takes listening to people like Gerard. Gerard, I'm going to move on to another question, and something that we are really interested in with this podcast, and that's always to ask why. Can you discuss why Black Lives Matter should matter to everyone, fisheries professionals, academics, managers, I mean, non-governmental organizations? Why should this matter to everyone?
If you haven't found out about me, I love to give context to these questions, because again, I recognize while Black Lives Matter is a center piece within our society today, that it's speaking to issues that have been around for centuries. So really, to understand Black Lives Matter is to understand the connection between policing and enslavement and labor. So when you think about policing was designed as a system to control and inflict punishment for the enslaved who sought freedom from their enslavers. And this is back in the 1700s. Even after slavery was abolished, the government imposed laws that are a constitutional amendment, you know, to abolish slavery, with the exception of folks who have committed crimes, when you think about the 13th Amendment. And so even though slavery was abolished, the government and individuals could re-enslave Black people through the convict leasing system. So this is where you see very petty, small crimes being criminalized to get Black people back into essentially slavery, just with another name. And there are documentaries like 13th and Slavery by Another Name that talk about this. Yep. And you know, we then have convict leasing systems. Fast forward a few decades, in the 70s through the 90s, we saw national rhetoric around getting tough on crime, law and order, addressing issues of drug use and war on drugs, where police were given permission and given increased levels of access to poor Black communities. As I mentioned before, particularly in the 1990s, we saw the militarization of the police. So police having military-grade weapons and vehicles to terrorize Black communities. So the Black community has always had an adverse relationship with the police because the function of policing is rooted in anti-Blackness. And now we're seeing the legacy of that. In the United States, the United States makes up 5% of the world's population and accounts for 30% of the world's incarcerated population. Despite Black people making up about 13% of the U.S. population, we make up upwards of 40% of the prison population. So disproportionately, we're affected by policing. We have to change that. And that's why all this matters. And I would argue that Black liberation would help advance the cause for all liberation, because anti-Blackness is rampant and so embedded into U.S. society and culture. If we understand how Black folks are impacted by systemic racism, then we begin to understand how systemic racism operates to then disproportionately and negatively affect other racially minoritized communities. And even beginning the conversation about how, you know, other systems of oppression work, like classism, sexism, heterosexism, and so forth. This movement should matter to everyone, not only because of the physical Black lives that have been lost. Certainly in the past couple months, in the past decade, and even past 401 plus years, we have to recognize that Black bodies always have been and continue to be targeted by everyone, by everything. Yeah. We also have to recognize how all liberation has to be connected. When we're able to liberate Black lives, I think that we'll start to see a new society emerge. And I think that that's so important. And this isn't to say Black liberation is more important than any other form of liberation, because, you know, you have scholars like Audre Lorde who said there's no hierarchy of oppression. So all oppression is connected. And the more we fight horizontally versus vertically, the longer we live in the state of being. And so beyond just the personal intrinsic desire to see everyone live happy, fulfilled, healthy lives, it's the idea that we're not going to get there and we're not going to be who we should be until we start fighting for the liberation of all these groups. And that's why this movement is so important, is because, again, it's a global network connecting folks across the diaspora and folks who are non-Black to say that Black lives truly matter, and that until Black lives can matter, we can't say that all lives matter.
Well, thank you. Mentioning a lot of fantastic points. You mentioned policing is rooted in anti-Blackness. That's a powerful phrase. Additionally, you've mentioned The 13th, which is on Netflix. And I would like to mention to all of our listeners, if you are just asking how or wondering how you can to understand Black oppression, or really to get more clarity on like policing, as Gerard mentions, that is a powerful film to watch on Netflix. So I highly recommend it. It's very educational. It's not about hating the police, but it's really just informing you what Black history looked like regarding policing that's been imposed on their lives. So I recommend everyone check that out. Gerard, have you ever been discriminated against or experienced systemic racism? I just think it's good for, if you want to share this, you don't have to, but I think it's great for people to just hear folks' stories, you know? I think it's more meaningful because people just don't know that it happened. So it's always good to hear someone's actual real life experience. So if you have like just a quick story to share, that would be cool.
There have been many ways that I've been discriminated against or felt the effects of systemic racism. I think that in terms of specifically around policing, you know, I've also had a pretty adverse relationship with the police throughout my life, not only with family, whether my immediate or extended family growing up, but also myself. I'm fortunate to have not ever had a run-in with the police that mirrors that of George Floyd clearly because I'm still, I'm here and fortunate for that. So yeah. I would say maybe not the extreme of those who might still be alive, but had, you know, a gun pointed at their face or were forced to the ground by the police. Or those who were wrongfully convicted of crimes by the prison industrial complex. So I'm fortunate to have not experienced those things, but, you know, I have even spoken to white peers that I have of just the differences in our interactions with the police from doing similar things. I've gotten pulled over by the police for having window tint that was too dark that came with the vehicle that I purchased. I've gotten pulled over by the police for sitting in my car and listening to music. I've gotten pulled over by the police for sitting in my car with another black friend. That time we had two police officers approach our vehicle and ask for both of our information. I've been pulled over by the police on my way home late at night. Unfortunately, my wife was there with me. You know, we were heading back from a different town. We're heading back home. You know, the way in which we were questioned by the police at that time already had a suspicion that they already had a suspicion or presumption of guilt in that moment. Oh. And luckily, they eventually let us go home. I've interacted with the police negatively more times than I would prefer to have in the future. Mm-hmm. And I think that as time goes, I really think about how lucky I've been in those instances that I'm still alive, because, you know, at many of those times that I've been pulled over, and that's not an exhaustive list of all the times I've been pulled over by the police, but, you know, in all those times, there have been a few times where I've been alone, where I've been later at night, where, you know, if something were to happen, people may not necessarily know what happened. And I also have, like, any time that I've been pulled over by the police more recently, I've had my phone and, you know, video camera, Facebook Live ready so that if anything were to happen, I could just publish that. So, you know, I always have a sense of concern, and I guess a sense of concern when I see the police on the road, when I see the police lights go off anytime I've ever been pulled over. And that translates into, you know, I have a 3.5-year-old son and a almost 11-month-old daughter. And, you know, we're going to have this conversation with them, have the talk with them about even these people who are paid public servants who are supposed to protect you may not always do that. Let's talk about how you can remain safe in these circumstances, because they have rights. I recognize that, you know, they're, of course, at a higher risk of, you know, being victims of police violence than, you know, a lot of their counterparts will be. And I guess it's a tough space to be in of how do you explain that and how do you have that conversation with your children, especially young children. You think about Tamir Rice, who was 12 years old when he was shot and killed by the police. You know, those are difficult conversations that we're going to have. I've experienced a lot of discrimination, a lot of targeting by the police, a lot of questioning by the police. And luckily, like I said, it hasn't escalated to the point where I've had a gun in my face or anything like that, but still very traumatic experiences.
Yeah, and those small little situations that can escalate into, you know, an unfortunate situation where a firearm is drawn or, you know, lethal force is, you know, is used. So that's, you know, it's very fortunate for you, like you said, that nothing has, you know, turned into anything like that. Okay, sorry if I've like been cutting you off, Aaron.
No, to be honest with you, this is, it's very appropriate for you guys to have this conversation and for me to step back, honestly. And I appreciate what both of you are saying. I have no context to what Gerard just described, I have personally not had a lot of those same issues. I think a lot of our listeners who are white probably are in the same boat as me and have not heard that type of thing before. So it's really enlightening. You hear stories of it and things that happen to other people. It's important to hear it from people that you do know. And maybe it's worth having a conversation with one of your friends of color or colleagues of color to get some context on this and see how they view the world and how policing has affected them. And a lot of our agencies, our state agencies, our federal agencies have conservation police officers. That's a big part of fisheries and wildlife is enforcement. Mm-hmm. And it's important for that community to also hear and try to make some changes to how they are approaching other races or people of color. Guys, we'll take a quick break and discuss the Hutton program.
This is Mary Webbin Lauren from AFS headquarters in Bethesda, Maryland. And did you know that AFS has a summer internship program for high school students who are interested in the field of fisheries and aquatic sciences? Our goal of the Hutton Junior Fisheries Biology Program is to recruit students from underrepresented backgrounds in science careers and use this internship to introduce and inspire the students to continue on a path to become a fisheries professional. This paid internship is between 7 and 8 weeks long, and the students receive $3,000. Since the program's inception in 2001, the Hutton program has placed 717 high school students from the United States, Mexico, and Canada in hands-on, research-based internship with current fisheries professionals. We are always looking for interested mentors to recruit students in their local areas to apply to the program. You are the inspiration for the next generation of fisheries professionals. Now let's hear from some Hutton program alumni about their time participating in the program.
The Hutton program was a great experience for me. During my internship with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, I learned many things about the fisheries and environmental field. This program was a hands-on experience because I was able to perform field work in several areas around my state, was exposed to a professional environment, and worked with professionals. This is a very rewarding program.
Ready to get hooked on the Hutton program? AFS is recruiting fisheries professionals to serve as mentors, whether in freshwater, marine, or aquaculture settings. Donate financially or in kind as a volunteer today. Mentor applications for the summer of 2021 will open in October. Visit the Hutton website for additional information and to donate and help the future generation of fisheries professionals.
All right, let's get back to the podcast.
Gerard, earlier you mentioned all lives can't matter and essentially until Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. My question is, what is your approach to someone that responds to you by saying all lives matter?
Oh, man. So I recognize I shared that before, and I'm just thinking, like, I think there's the underlying goal of course, all lives matter. But, you know, I'm challenged by this phrase because, and personally, I don't address it much anymore. So a lot of folks say, I've heard a lot of folks say all lives matter, or blue lives matter. For one, like, I'm not a fan of co-opting movements. All lives matter isn't a movement and only emerged when Black Lives Matter became popular. Many folks who say all lives matter don't understand the history I shared before. And you can try comparing it to other things. Saying all cancers matter at a breast cancer rally or breast cancer awareness rally is problematic. Like, that might be an effective approach for folks. I personally prefer to educate about why we say Black Lives Matter and call all lives matter into question. Like, what, and if we talk about all lives matter, like, what is the mission? What are the central tenets? What work are all lives matter advocates doing? Who created that movement? How are they organized? Because I personally don't see all lives matter in support of any actual lives, but rather as a distancing response to Black Lives Matter. And also, the inclusion of Black lives doesn't include others. It's just the focus of the conversation. And so, like I said, I think that I focus on the education around it of not necessarily trying to find all the ways to compare different movements or different phrases so that folks understand. But more so, my energy, I feel like I spend just trying to educate, like, this is what Black Lives Matter actually is and what they actually do. And when you say all lives matter, this is what that looks like. When you're comparing a grounded, solid global movement to a phrase that people say because they feel threatened.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, relationship building, like I said before, is an important process of movement building. You know, my hope is that for folks who are addressing or responding to those who are saying all lives matter, do so in a way where they try to have the best intentions of the people that they're educating. In some ways, they can humanize that experience. Some strategies that I've used broadly in even just social justice education is thinking about questioning. So questioning what they're saying, asking them if what they're saying is what they really mean, because this is how it sounds. Educating. So sharing the perspective that I just gave of, like, this is what the Black Lives Matter movement actually is. So what is All Lives Matter beyond just a hashtag that's used in opposition? And then, you know, expressing a personal emotional reaction. So talking about how, you know, when you say All Lives Matter, this is how it makes me feel as a person, as a Black person, even as a white person. This is how you saying that makes me feel. What do you do, or how would you feel if someone said this in response to something that you deeply care about or are passionate about? And then, you know, offering a reframe of, you are concerned about the movement, not only learn more about the movement, but think about, like, how can you make sure that all lives really do matter? So not only supporting Black lives, but, you know, when Indigenous communities are continuously being flooded by subpar economic support, you know, they're fighting for land rights and looking to disrupt pipelines that go through sacred lands and communities, like, do All Lives Matter still apply there? When you have Latinx communities who are in cages at the border, who are worried that they might be deported because of the, you know, inconsistencies and the lack of security with DACA, like, do All Lives still matter? When we had international students who were worried that they might not be able to study in the United States because of, you know, recent legislation that came down from the federal government, like, do all lives still matter in these circumstances? And if you're not saying all lives matter in those times, then truly you're saying it in opposition to a movement about Black lives, which reinforces anti-Black racism. I'll get off my soapbox for that one. But, you know, I think that it really just depends on who that person is talking to and the relationship that they have. Like, that's probably how I would respond, but yeah. I think that folks have to find the best way that works for them and the people that they're advocating for. Social media often can be a great place to advocate and to connect and have these conversations, and sometimes it can completely destroy conversations and relationships. So I think that we have to tread carefully about how we do that.
100% agree with you on the social media aspect.
Yeah. That was deep.
that's as elaborate and eloquent as I have ever heard anybody discuss that. And I really appreciate that. I really do.
I do that. Too. I mean, that whole response was just, it was perfect. I mean, it just, because it just went even further than, I mean, it really defined what All Lives Matter essentially should really mean. And it just put everything into a good perspective. And it dove deeper than just Black lives. I thought it was very educational. And I love that point of focusing on educating, you know, putting all of your time and effort into that aspect, you know, rather than arguing with someone, trying to just simply educate them. And I think, and to question them, you know, that was one of the first points that I made in our pilot episode. And it's really good to, and reassuring to hear that someone who's professionally in this job sector, they're using a tactic that I was considering using, or am considering using, for folks. So, man, well said. Well said, Gerard.
I picked up on your approach on our intro. What did I say? What does it really mean? I picked up on that from what Gerard just mentioned. So that, and I actually wrote that down. So that's interesting. We're both on the same page there.
Y'all got me fired up today.
This is deep and powerful stuff that needs to be out there.
Yeah.
That's why we're doing this.
And Gerard, I mean, that, you know, just that last answer, man, I wish I almost just at some point out of the whole podcast too, I would love to just take that. I just want to send that to people, because seriously, because it's upsetting and frustrating that it seems like people use that phrase to just undermine, you know, Black lives, or you know, they just don't know that they're supporting anti-Black racism. And it was educational. It didn't come across as attacking, but it should make you question your logic.
You know, my thinking around it really is just that I try to, as much as possible, assume good intentions, because I recognize that we're products of the media and information that we consume. And so, you know, there's literature out there about our cycles of socialization and how we learn and understand our world, our place in the world, and how that's reinforced. And I recognize that, you know, when you hear messages that, you know, all lives matter, or Black people are less than, whether directly or indirectly through, you know, your parents, peer groups, teachers, faith-based institutions, if you have them, through media. I mean, if you're consistently getting a similar message, you're going to internalize that. Unless there's some way that you liberate yourself from that, you're going to continue to reinforce that cycle through generations. And so that's exactly what's happened. And so I try to recognize that our generational ignorance is a byproduct of white supremacy versus people's, you know, willingness to be ignorant or desire to be ignorant. And that's not to say that some people aren't just ignorant, because they are. But especially folks who are new to the conversation, I recognize that the exposure to anything different, I mean, it's completely changing the worldview when you say Black Lives Matter. And so, you know, we have to think about how do we address folks in a way that's educational and humanizes these experiences, because it's an emotional process to unlearn everything that you thought was true for your entire life. And so that's what really grounds me in thinking about how do I approach people who say all lives matter, or that racism doesn't exist, or whatever thing comes up.
Yeah. And for me, as a white privileged male, I'm sitting here listening and getting a good understanding of what you're saying, but also realizing, even though I have had no outright intentions of being racist or anything like that throughout my life, you are exactly right in that trying to evolve and understand the little things really matter. I've just, throughout this whole podcast series and just the training that I've received, I'm trying to personally pick apart those details of how I have gone about my thinking as far as diversity and inclusion. Have I personally truly thought in those terms throughout my life and throughout my career? And anybody listening to this, probably along those same lines. And it's all about personal growth. I mentioned, relative to the first podcast that we did, adaptive management context, in terms of you learn from the past to help build natural resources for the betterment in the future, and you make tweaks along the way, and that applies here too. Gerard, this is a fisheries podcast. We really appreciate all the context behind everything that you've mentioned. And ultimately, people need to know, fisheries professionals, academics, whoever, you know, we work in these professional settings. Many of us also have to work directly with the public. And so across those two spaces, what tools can we as fisheries professionals do to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion in our workspaces, but also when working with the public?
Yeah, definitely. I'll start by saying that, you know, throughout this podcast, what I've been trying to convey is, in my remarks, is that these issues are systemic and historic, that they didn't appear in May with George Floyd's murder, and that they aren't isolated. As we particularly think back to police violence and the Black Lives Matter movement as a whole. So if we understand higher education as a microcosm of society, we have to understand that racism in society inevitably trickles down to our higher education institutions. I think that you can see this by even looking at Clemson, where, you know, the first black student wasn't admitted into Clemson after being sued until 1963, almost a decade after integration. Black people account for 27% of the state's population and about only 6% of Clemson's student body. And faculty members aren't great either. And the majority of people in leadership at Clemson, when you think about like deans, vice presidents, and their direct reports, most of those folks are white, and white men in particular. And a significant number of, you know, food service workers and maintenance workers are black or people of color. Those are all important things and concepts to consider when we think about our workplace as a whole. I recognize that the Gantt Center and centers like multicultural centers like the Gantt Center are the direct response of student activism, and particularly black student activism and their allies, holding the institution accountable for not providing adequate support to address their needs. Again, as I mentioned before, racism is endemic and it's deeply embedded into every aspect of our lives, and we can't ignore it. So to understand how to move forward in terms of fisheries and like how, not only how do we create more equitable spaces, but also, you know, working with the community, it's important to understand all of that context so that you know exactly what you're working against as well as working toward. In terms of building those relationships, a major piece, I think, is building your intercultural competence. So I worked at, like I said before, I worked at the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences at the University of Minnesota. And we would often get requests from people in fisheries, wildlife, and other areas to send a list of high-achieving Black Indigenous students of color. You know, there was no desire to actually build a meaningful relationship or address the ways in which organizations may have upheld problematic, oppressive, and minimizing environments. So building intercultural competence allows folks to actually work within communities in ways that are appropriate and authentic to those communities. The recognition that, you know, relationship building is important, and that if you're visible and have a relationship with the communities that you work with, or that those communities are able to access particular workspaces, you know, that makes the world of difference. So that, you know, the first time they're hearing from folks isn't when they want someone to apply to their program or come apply to their organization, but that it's a longstanding relationship. Outreach should start early. So thinking about how can you connect with elementary, middle school, and high school children to build a pipeline, connecting with agricultural schools in the community to develop programs for students. For example, is there an experience they go through where if they apply to Clemson, eventually apply to Clemson, that they get a significant scholarship or a full ride to attend by participating in this pipeline program, recognizing that it's going to take resources and dollars to get the outcomes that we want to see as well. Thinking about how the department is defining diversity, equity, and inclusion, and is it truly embedded into every piece of the work that they're doing and their experiences? Are you creating a competitive space to attract, retain, and promote faculty and staff of color? How is diversity, equity, inclusion being acknowledged, celebrated, and rewarded within the department or organization? What are other schools doing well in terms of engaging the community? How can you partner with local HBCUs to create accelerated or connected degree programs to get more representation in developing an MOU between those institutions? Does the DEI position within your college have decision-making power? Do they have the power to influence the dean? Are they directly reporting to the dean? And if not, you know, what barriers can exist by having that bureaucracy? How strong are the relationships between the institution and community, and how can they be strengthened? As a land-grant institution, which I recognize the land-grant mission in many ways is problematic based on the founding of many of our institutions through the Morrill Act in the 1800s. How are we fulfilling our outreach mission as a land grant to truly serve the communities and all communities that we come in contact with? And then how are you addressing structural and cultural factors that may prevent access to this type of work? you know, finally, how are you engaging diverse alumni who have gone through these programs, who are out in the field, in these organizations, or in the communities that you're looking to be in community with and in relationship with? That's kind of a mixture of some of the thoughts I have and also important questions that I think one could ask. You know, I think that the more you can involve the community in the work, the better. And so it would be a matter of those folks working with those communities to build their intercultural competence so that they can work in those communities effectively and truly understand the needs of the community and how organizations in general can truly and effectively meet the needs of those communities, not only from a access standpoint, but also from source standpoint in terms of like what actual issues are those communities having, those who are connected. Like, how can you improve the conditions for those communities as well? So I hope that answers your question. But those are some ideas or recommendations that I have initially to build those relationships. And there's a lot more that could happen in order to do that. But
all right, along those lines of community, a future podcast episode, we're going to bring in Ernest Muhammad, who's a fisheries biologist with the South Carolina DNR. He's also the executive director of the Low Country Alliance for Model Communities. And he'll be here to discuss diversity in the profession through recruitment, give us a case study of his very important work in South Carolina. So be on the lookout for that. It's directly related to what Gerard just mentioned. Dion, I'd love for you to give the last word with this podcast. I'm going to say, Gerard, this has been very meaningful to me, and I really appreciate the relationship that we're beginning to build. Personally, I look forward to future interactions with you here at Clemson, and I just really appreciate you coming on and really pouring your heart into today's podcast.
Yeah, of course, and thank you all for giving me this platform to speak and, you know, share something that's important to me personally, but also something that should be of value to society as well.
To kind of wrap everything up, Gerard, I just want to also say thanks for joining us. And I really hope you know that all of your information that you've given us today, all your responses, I mean, they were very educational and eye-opening. I appreciate everything that you had to offer today. So thank you.
Yeah, of course.
Special thanks to the Fisheries Podcast for hosting us on their established feed at fisheriespodcast.podbean.com and for also tackling important diversity and inclusion topics in their normal feed. Also, find us and other diversity and inclusion resources on diversity.fisheries.org. This episode was produced and edited by Aaron Bunch and Dion Kerr. The custom lo-fi music beat was crafted by Darius Armstrong. Look for his music name, Karl Marx, on www.bandcamp.com/releases. We are very grateful to all those AFS leaders and members who have provided support and feedback as we have brought this podcast to life.